Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. Adding to our series on real-life adventures and ancient mysteries and new science discoveries, meet Charles Gollenkamp. He has researched most thoroughly the real-life action-adventure story of some of the first expeditions to go hunt dinosaurs. And he's here to tell us about that. He's written the book Dragon Hunters. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
You know, Dragon Hunters is such an apt name because I'm assuming that the very first dinosaur bones, especially of those T-Rex types that were unearthed, must have looked to those early scientists, those early discoverers, like dragons. And don't you find it interesting that the mythology of dragons, these big lizard creatures with wings, occurred hundreds of years before we actually found and knew what dinosaur bones were, and they were actually those kind of lizard-like creatures, very gigantic, and some of them flew. I just find that very interesting.
It is indeed, and particularly goes far back into Chinese and Asian mythology. And of course, the Chinese and Mongols thought that the bones of dinosaurs were the actual bones of dragons, and they were highly prized for medicinal purposes. Consequently, the earliest studies of paleontology in China were made largely in apothecary shops where scientists would go in and just buy dragon bones off the shelf or dinosaur bones off the shelf and try to classify them. And so when the subject of my biography, which has just come out, Dragon Hunter, Roy Chapman Andrews and the Central Asiatic Expeditions, when Andrews and his men went to China, went to Mongolia, they became known as the American Men of the Dragon Bones for this reason.
The Chinese have them aptly named.
Yes.
Do you think that some of those early mythologies arose about dragons because of some of the bones that were found? I mean, people were finding dinosaur bones way back when, right? They would almost, in some cases, unearth themselves due to erosion and such. Mm-hmm. Is that where the idea got started, do you suppose, or did it have other origins?
I honestly haven't the slightest idea where the mythology of dragons began in Oriental mythology. I'm not a student of Chinese history in that sense.
Just curious.
And I'm not sure anybody does know, frankly.
Well, tell us about this early dinosaur hunter and, mounting an expedition. In what year was this again?
Well, Andrews worked in Mongolia between 1922 and 1930. And I should clarify at the outset that we're talking about really two Mongolias. There is was at that time Outer Mongolia, which became known as it is today as the People's Republic of Mongolia, which in 1924 fell under the orb of Russian domination. And then there is Inner Mongolia, which is an autonomous region of China under Chinese control. But the Gobi Desert, oddly enough, extends completely across the southern part of what was then Outer Mongolia and then turns slightly northward and goes up into Inner Mongolia, so that Andrews' expeditions worked in both areas. In 1922 and 23 and 25, he was in Outer Mongolia. And when the communists took that over and closed it to Western scientists, he had to shift his operations to China and to Inner Mongolia, where he made two more subsequent expeditions, one in 1928 and one in 1930.
And China, of course, has also been the site of very recent and important dinosaur discoveries. So
indeed,
it's quite a dinosaur ground. Weren't
yes.
the original or the first eggs, dinosaur
yes.
egg?
Well, yes, the first eggs were actually found in... they found a fragment of an egg on the first expedition to Outer Mongolia in 1923. and they assumed it was a fossilized bird's egg.
Ah, and they didn't put the two together.
No, nobody at that time really knew how dinosaurs were born, whether they were, you know, born directly from the mother, or whether they were born from eggs, or exactly how. I don't think anyone had really given it much thought. And then when they went back in 1923, one of the paleontologists on the expedition, George Olson, suddenly came into camp one day, and he said he had found a nest, a complete nest, of these strange eggs. And he was absolutely certain that they were dinosaur eggs. So everybody got up from the luncheon table and ran out into the field with great skepticism to see, have a look at these things. And Walter Granger, who was the expedition's chief paleontologist and scientific coordinator, picked these one of these up and examined it, and he looked at it, and he said, they're absolutely reptilian. They look like the eggs of many modern reptiles. And they
Ancestry.
Yeah, about 8 inches long and about rough on the outside, smooth on the inside. And a couple of them had what appeared to be little embryos that were visible on the inside. Then they began to find these eggs all over the place, and it became known as the Great Dinosaur Egg Hunt. Now, we're talking about an area quite deep into the Gobi. Known as the Flaming Cliffs, more popular name, because they're bright red sandstone cliffs in a pink basin, absolutely beautiful area. If you look on a map, the site is marked as Shabarak Ushu today, or Banzak. It has two different names, but it's really known to paleontologists around the world as the Flaming Cliffs, and it is famous as one of the richest, most rewarding dinosaur hunting grounds ever discovered.
Does everywhere on Earth where dinosaurs roamed, and they were pretty much covering all parts, land and sea, are they rich with dinosaur fossils, but it's in the desert that you find them more easily because they're better preserved,
well,
and because you don't have a lot of stuff on top of the outer layer?
It's in the desert that you find them more easily. It's in exposed areas, and particularly deeply eroded areas where water has cut down through geological strata
back
that exposed.
65 million years ago.
And instead of having to try to clear away underbrush or look for them under almost impossible conditions in heavily forested areas, here they are. They're just lying there on the surface. And I know when my wife and I were at the Flaming Cliffs in 1995, we were walking everywhere we walked. There were fragments of bone just coming up out of the earth. And most of the great dinosaur collecting areas, Montana, Wyoming, western Alberta and Canada, Africa now, recently the Sahara. Just last week they announced the discovery of a huge dinosaur in North Africa. These are all in exposed areas where these bones can be seen.
So it makes the digging easy. What is your passion for dinosaurs? Why have you devoted so much of your
I've loved dinosaurs research? All my life. I was actually educated as an archaeologist. I started out working traces of early man in North America. And that's very closely tied to paleontology, because the first inhabitants of the North American continent, who were here perhaps 10 to 12,000 years ago, and that's a debatable figure, but generally accepted by most archaeologists, they were, after all, hunting extinct animals. They were hunting mastodons, and they were hunting giant sloth, and they were hunting saber-toothed tigers. And if you've ever been to Los Angeles and gone to the La Brea tar pits in the La Brea Museum, you see a great many of these animals that were present when man was around 10 to 12,000 years ago, but that then became extinct. And I think that awakened a peripheral interest in paleontology that grew through the years. Also, Andrews has fascinated me as an individual for many years, because I was an apprentice at the American Museum prep school student days in New York.
He was quite a figure there.
And I got to meet him on several occasions, and I began to read all of his famous books like Under a Lucky Star and On the Trail of Ancient Man and Ends of the Earth that I think stimulated a generation, two generations perhaps, of dinosaur hunters who are now out active in the field. And he symbolized adventure for millions and millions of people, and he was indeed one of the great adventurers of all time. I mean, he ranks with Perry, he ranks with Shackleton, he ranks with Admiral Byrd, he ranks with the greatest explorers that we've seen in the 20th century. And his expeditions were done on an enormous scale. He raised over $600,000 for these ventures, which in those days was the equivalent of millions and millions of dollars. And you can imagine the buying power in China of that kind of money.
Yeah.
And being a man of many facets, being an entrepreneur, a master showman, highly skilled at manipulating the press for the good of his expeditions and his own good, not incidentally, a world-class polo player, a sportsman. What else can I say about this man? He had so many facets. A scientist, a zoologist, one of the world's foremost authorities on whales, particularly Pacific whales, which occupied the early part of his career. He went to people like J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Charles Frick and W. Averill Harriman and George F. Baker and on through the whole roster of Wall Street giants of the 1920s and raised this money single-handedly and was able to sell them on really what was rather at that time can only be described as an audacious, if not madcap, plan, and that was to try to take automobiles across the Gobi Desert supplied by camel caravans, which would meet up with the automobiles at given points in the desert, rendezvous points, 2 or 3 weeks apart. Simple enough in concept, but very difficult to carry out because there were no maps of the Gobi in those days, and nobody knew what kind of terrain the cars would run into if they got off this great gravel plain that the Gobi consists of mainly. But it also has vast areas of eroded badlands, mountains, sand dunes. And, of course, the other problem was the fact that the Gobi was swarming with bandits, literally swarming with thousands
of
bandits.
Why would he need a car as opposed to camels? Or the
well, with a car, he could travel 100 miles a day as opposed to 10 miles a day with a camel. And so if they were in areas that were unproductive scientifically, they could get through them quickly. And there were some areas that were. Another factor was that he could only work approximately 5 months each year because the Gobi's climate in the wintertime is absolutely suicidal to go into. It's just below Siberia. It's a very high desert. Most of it lies about 3,500 feet above sea level. And these great Siberian Arctic storms come down over Mongolia, and temperatures will drop as low as 35 to 40 degrees. Even temperatures as low as 80 degrees have been below zero have been registered in the Gobi. So they would simply have been stranded in snow and never have made it back. And they had to operate efficiently in the quickest possible time.
How did the cars fare then?
Pardon me?
Did he get the cars and how did they fare? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that another reason for using the cars, and this was a very important part of his concept, revolutionary concept, was that with automobiles he could divide his expedition into several different sections, segments. For example, the paleontologist could take a car, driver, supplies, gasoline, interpreter, equipment, whatever was needed, and go off and dig fossils in one area, while the archaeologist, equipped with their own transportation and necessary equipment, could work in another area. The geologist could do the same thing. The map makers, the cartographers, perhaps, could stay behind and map areas that took many days longer than other aspects of the expedition might take. So this way he could break the expedition up, and then they would agree to meet back at a base camp at a certain point and compare notes and see where it appeared to be most lucrative to go next and what to do next. So it gave him an enormous amount of flexibility they never would have had with camels, obviously.
What sort of discoveries did he unearth? What did he bring back? Some wonderful, wonderful finds.
Well, I preface this by saying that one of the things that makes this story so interesting, and one of the things that made Andrews such a almost icon, I guess, for millions and millions of admirers, was the fact that he took one of the great gambles in the history of science. That is, before he went into the Gobi, nothing in the way of a fossil had ever been found there. In fact, most scientists had written off the Gobi as a wasteland with nothing of interest. One tooth of an extinct rhinoceros had been picked up in 1894 by an explorer along a caravan trail, but it was generally assumed that this was found somewhere else and was dropped by traders who were taking it to market because, as I said earlier, these fossils or these dragon bones had enormous value as for medicinal uses. But everyone said that there were no fossils in the Gobi Desert, and one Chinese scientist who had explored the area a bit said you might as well search the Pacific Ocean for fossils as go into the Gobi. But Andrews was convinced that they were there, and he was convinced that it was an ideal place to look for them.
What convinced him that they were there? Just logically?
I think an instinct, and I think the fact that, as he said, nobody's ever looked for them.
Oh.
As simple as that. He said nobody's ever really looked for them, and there could not be an area that big, that huge, that ideal for searching without there being some kind of trace of ancient life. And they chose Mongolia and the Gobi Desert rather than other parts of Central Asia, such as Afghanistan, which is barren enough to search, because it was close to Peking, and it gave easy access, maintaining a headquarters in Peking, operating from that headquarters, and going right through the Great Wall and right up onto the Mongolian Plateau. And so logistically, it was much simpler than trying to operate out of other parts of Central Asia that did not have this kind of proximity. And from Peking, of course, the fossils could be shipped short distance to the port at Tientsin, put on a boat, and brought right over to New York to the American Museum of Natural History, which was sponsoring these expeditions.
Good logistical fit, then.
Yes. And He took this enormous gamble, and within 3 days after entering Inner Mongolia, they weren't even in Outer Mongolia yet, they began to find the remains of fossils, both of mammals and of dinosaurs. And Andrews knew then that his gamble was in all probability going to pay off. By the time they reached the Flaming Cliffs and other parts of the southern and western Gobi, the amount of fossil dinosaurs and mammals was simply staggering. He realized that he had stumbled into a treasure trove. And I think serendipity played a huge part in this. He believed in it. It was logical to him that animals should have existed there. And it was an ideal hunting ground, and it was close to Peking, and he went for it.
Now, do you suppose that there were so many fossils that anywhere he looked he would have found them, or did he come up with a lot of dry wells, so to speak, beforehand? Or how much effort was it to?
There were areas that were barren, but not very many. And the interesting thing is that when he finally was forced by political circumstances, which became prohibitive with the Chinese, the onset of the warlord era in China and the communist takeover of Outer Mongolia in 1924 and 25, he was not able, he knew he was leaving behind a treasure trove of undiscovered materials.
Yeah.
And also, he was not able to go into the far western Gobi because he didn't have enough gas. He mm-hmm. couldn't to supply his cars for that much of a distance. And the area was so remote, had anything gone wrong, the expedition would just simply have perished. They were using Dodge Brothers touring cars mm-hmm. with no special equipment other than extra heavy springs and winches and things of that nature on them. And those cars were amazingly rugged, and they never failed him. But he had to get gasoline to them, and they could only carry so much gas on the camel caravans. So now, since the end of World War II and the breaking down of political barriers and the onset of cooperative efforts between different countries, the Poles have gone back in to Mongolia. The Russians have made several major expeditions. The Mongols themselves have instituted several expeditions. And with the breakdown of the communist regime in 1989 and 1990, and their withdrawal from the People's Republic of Mongolia, lo and behold, a Mongolian scientist came to the American Museum of Natural History and proposed that, that they bury the hatchet, cooperate, go back in and re-explore many of the sites that Andrews had wanted to explore and had planned to explore, hopefully, and many that he already had explored. And these expeditions, which have been going on now since every summer, since about 1991, have turned up literally untold thousands of specimens, along with, when the Russian expeditions went in, they took out something like 70 tons of fossils on one expedition. And so Andrews was quite right when he said he knew he was leaving behind a treasure trove, and work since then is proving that, and more discoveries are being made of a more and more revolutionary nature.
What are some of those discoveries that are...
Well, for
because
example...
Because it seems every year our idea of what the dinosaurs were about are changing and
absolutely.
Adapting.
Absolutely. For one thing, the villain of the movie Jurassic Park...
Oh, the T-Rex.
...was a creature called Velociraptor. He had the great talons on his feet and the jagged teeth, which he could use to rip prey apart. Velociraptor in the movie is depicted with a reptilian skin. Well, to everybody's surprise, there is a great deal of evidence now coming out of these new discoveries that Velociraptor was feathered, that he was one of the dinosaurs on its way to becoming a bird. The link between birds and dinosaurs is well established. Yes, the little feet on the bird's wings, the little vestiges of feet. And there's a breastbone that birds have that almost of the sauropod dinosaurs had that no other animal has. And
that particular curve that gives
that's right.
kind of shape to the...
Mm-hmm. We've been able to trace the evolution of that breastbone very actively through the ages. And Oviraptor, another of the great dinosaurs that Andrews found, also had feathers, two or three other species of feathered dinosaurs.
When you say feathers, do you mean full-fledged feathers as birds have today, or were there a kind of a prototype of feather?
Proto-feathers. They looked more like ostrich feathers.
What do ostrich feathers look like? Sort of short and downy, or?
Well, they're rather spiny.
Spiny, okay,
yes, rather than plume-like. Although some of the dinosaurs appear to have had short plumage on certain parts of their body, but by and large, the feathers were spiny more than anything else. They certainly couldn't fly with them, no doubt about that.
How do you suppose? What was evolutionary Mother Nature thinking when she gave these dinosaurs these feathers?
Well, there has
to be a reason for them.
That's a very good question, you see, because they were on their way to becoming birds. And had their evolution been allowed to proceed, they probably would have gotten full feathers, started to leap, started to leave the ground, maybe
been,
developed
been really
wings,
been those dragons.
And, you know, here we have suddenly large flying dinosaurs. We had things like Archaeopteryx, which flew a long time before that. But there was a thing, a terrible disaster that happened called the Great Extinction Event.
Mm-hmm.
About 65 million years ago, at the end of what's known geologically as the Cretaceous period. And that extinction event is caused, there are various theories as to what caused it, but the best theory seems to be now that a gigantic asteroid struck the Earth off the coast of Yucatan, in the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, from the air, you can still see the outline of a massive depression.
Chicxulub. Yeah.
Exactly. And that this knocked water out of the oceans, that it kicked up mud and sand and dirt, and that it disrupted the whole balance of life on Earth. In all probability, a cloud of dust arose that blocked out the sun, and it changed the environment so drastically that many of these larger dinosaurs could not survive. Smaller ones obviously did and went on to become the birds that we know today. Now, interestingly, at the Flaming Cliffs...
You have to tell us in just a moment because we have to take a break. Certainly. And we continue this conversation with Charles Gallenkamp. His book is Dragon Hunter. It's about the early Mongolian expeditions of Roy Chapman Andrews. Quite a guy. And he led the way for some important early discoveries on America's behalf. And he'll tell us more about that and some of the latest dinosaur discoveries when we come back. I'm Laura Lee. We continue our conversation for exploration with Charles Gallenkamp's put in a wonderfully detailed body of research about early dinosaur hunter Roy Chapman Andrews, and his book is Dragon Hunter. You're telling us about some of the discoveries of dinosaurs, and it's just so interesting how from the very start to the present we're still evolving our ideas about what those dinosaurs are. And how long ago was it that the bird-dinosaur connection was firmly made? And what are some of those discoveries? We found that dinosaurs sat on their nests like birds. They behaved like birds. They nested like birds. They were... are birds...
At the Flaming Cliffs...
Oh, you were about to tell us. Thank you.
They found a nest of dinosaur eggs. And there was a 4-inch layer of sand on top of it, and on top of that sand lay a previously unknown dinosaur, which we now today called Oviraptor, which is misnamed because it
Ovo
means
egg?
A monster, or rather the creature that the
lays eggs
with a taste for eggs.
Oh, that likes to eat eggs.
That liked to eat eggs, and hence Oviraptor.
Oh, so it was hunting the nest for food.
I need to backtrack here a minute and say that the most prevalent dinosaur found at the Flaming Cliffs was a creature called Protoceratops. Or Protoceratops andrewsi, after Andrews, and they're found there literally by the hundreds, and they had swarmed all over the Gobi. They've been found in many, many, many locations. It was a small dinosaur, about 8 to 9 feet long. It had a beak like a parrot. It had a big bony plate behind its head. Strange-looking thing. And at first, it was assumed. In fact, it was assumed until very recently that Protoceratops had laid the eggs that were being found at the Flaming Cliffs, and subsequently found at other locations in the Gobi, and that what this nest with the sand and the Oviraptor signified was that Oviraptor was a predator that was preying on the nest of the Protoceratops eggs. Well, we now know that just the opposite was probably true.
Really?
That Oviraptor is misnamed, that Oviraptor laid these eggs, because we've since found, the American Museum expeditions have since found entire embryos in eggs and entire nests that contain not the skeletons of Protoceratops inside them, but the skeletons of Oviraptors inside them. And so there's very little doubt left that Oviraptor was not the villain. It was probably Protoceratops who was preying on the eggs.
Doesn't that turn topsy-turvy the ratio of predator to prey? Because you said that the Protoceratops were overrunning the plane.
I think that there must have been many Oviraptors also in the area.
To support the population of predators.
To lay these eggs. They just simply haven't found as many of the skeletons as they have of Protoceratops at this point. But I'm sure that they will ultimately. And no scientist today doubts that Oviraptor did indeed lay the famous eggs that drew so much publicity. But I was, I need to point out that in the midst of this extinction event of 65 million years ago, where the sun may have been blotted out and many of the larger dinosaurs could not adapt to their environment, because adaptation to environment is one of the key driving forces of evolution. Those animals that adapt best to their environment are the ones that survive, obviously. Is survival of the fittest.
Sometimes the small ships are able to move the quickest,
according to Darwin's concepts. The fittest were those who were the strongest and who could adapt. And we still see that going on today, as a matter of fact, in every day almost in the paper. There are articles about bacteria that are becoming resistant to certain kinds of antibiotics. And that's because that bacteria is adapting to whatever it was in that antibiotic that originally killed it. And this is truly evolution in action, right in front of our eyes. You can see it under microscopes. But in the middle of this drama, this great earthly drama that was going on 65 million years ago, roughly, there were running around the Earth tiny little mammals, many of them not much larger than rats, many of them the size of shrews. Some were found, the first ones were found at the Flaming Cliffs, and they found, I think, 11 specimens of skulls all together. They didn't fill a cigar box, but Andrews considered them to be among the most valuable, if not the most valuable, discoveries he made, because it proved that Central Asia had played a major role in the evolution and dispersal of mammals. Certainly not the only place on Earth that this took place, but a very important place. And this was one of the theories that sent him out into the field. It was the attempt to prove that this evolutionary process with mammals had occurred in somewhere in Central Asia. The same was true of humans. He was searching for the remains of early primates or early anthropoids, none of which he ever found. Africa turned out to be the Garden of Eden for mankind. But here were these mammals, and it was the beginning, the end of the big dinosaurs, the beginning of what we call the Cenozoic era geologically, or the Age of Mammals, which led directly to the development of some very, very strange creatures that Andrews brought out of the Gobi.
Can you describe some of them?
Well, one of them was a fierce thing called a Embolotherium, which looked like, if you can imagine, something rather like a rhinoceros, but instead of a horn on its head, it had a gigantic battering ram that it could run into enemies with and crush. Another one of my favorites, was Platybelodon, which was a member of the elephant family, but it had no trunk. Instead, it had two large teeth, shovel-like teeth, about 18 inches across, that it used to scoop up food from riverbanks and stream beds and put in its mouth and then grind up and eat.
Were those early tusks, in a sense?
Had little tiny tusks that pointed downward, not out, downward, as if to help perhaps dig along those stream banks.
My nature does like to experiment,
right,
doesn't it?
Right.
What are some other of these odd creatures?
And, pardon me?
What are some of these other odd creatures?
Well, another one was, I guess, one of the most important was the thing that was known for years as Baluchotherium, and or the Beast of Baluchistan, which was first found by a British scientist. In Baluchistan, it may well have been the largest mammal that ever lived on Earth. It was a distant relative again of the rhinoceros. It stood 17 feet approximately at the shoulder and reached a length of 24 feet, and it had a long neck like a giraffe that enabled it to use its prehensile lips to graze in the tops of trees. And it was an absolute behemoth, a monstrous creature. When one of the paleontologists first discovered the bones, he came back to camp and said he'd found bones as big as my body. And this happened to be J.B. Shackelford, the photographer, who was quite a portly man. And so it attracted everyone's attention. And sure enough, these bones are absolutely massive. The skull alone is over five feet long.
Jeez.
And Coryphodon is another of the strange creatures. Looked rather like a pig with fangs, and many other fossils as mammals that had never been seen before.
You know, that's another important adjustment we need to make to our thinking, is that when we think of the various sizes and shapes of dinosaurs, the large, the small, the long neck, the odd apertures and all that, some of those are mammals, some of those were reptiles, some of those were protobirds. What other genus do we have here of the various types of animals? But we tend to think of all dinosaurs as reptiles.
Yes.
So we need to correct that impression.
Yeah.
And where does Bob Backer's warm-blooded dinosaur theory fit in? Is he looking at the mammalian dinosaurs and saying, yeah, they're warm-blooded?
No, I don't think so. I think he's looking at dinosaur behavior. You know, a cold-blooded mammal has to sit on rocks in the sun in order to absorb heat.
To get itself going.
Or spend an awful lot of time in the sun in order to absorb heat into its body, just like cold-blooded reptiles today. You'll see snakes coiled on rocks, and you see crocodiles or alligators on the banks of rivers gathering up sun, usually from rocky areas, because the rocks absorb the heat and convey it. Dinosaurs seem to have been moving too much to do that. They seem to have been too active. They seem to have been on massive migrations from time to time. In fact, there is evidence coming out of the work that's been done recently in China by a Canadian scientist and Chinese scientist, that a land bridge connected North and South America and with Asia, and that dinosaurs could go back and forth and did do that. And it seems rather impractical to see them stopping wherever they found a rock to try to get some body heat. And I think that plus a number of other morphological factors and physiological factors led to the theory of the warm-blooded dinosaur, which of course has not yet been fully established. One thing I would like to say, if I may take a minute about my biography of Andrews, is that this is not strictly a science book. This is a book about Andrews and his times, which were every bit as interesting as, in many ways, as the discoveries. The discoveries have certainly left their impact on science today and continue to do so and will continue to do so. But Andrews was one of the most interesting men of the last century, the 21st century. He was a master entrepreneur, a socialite. He was knew how to manipulate the press, as I mentioned earlier, perfectly. He was a marvelous lecturer. He was obviously a gifted fundraiser. And he was as much at home in the drawing rooms of Rockefeller and Morgan as he was, I've just been corrected here, I said 21st century, it should have been 20th century, my apologies. Anyway, he was as much at home in the drawing rooms of Morgan and Rockefeller as he was riding with Mongol nomads or sitting in a geisha, a tea house, watching geishas in Japan. And he was a multifaceted individual.
Was it his particular vision that propelled these expeditions? Do you suppose they wouldn't have happened if he hadn't geared up and led the charge and collected the financing?
I think they never would have happened if he had not been the
leading light.
Yes, that's right. And because he had the right personality, the right persona, the right amount of determination and drive. He could be extremely diplomatic when necessary, and he could be very forceful when necessary, even to the point of pulling his gun, you know. And he was truly an adventurer in the classic sense of the word,
and a Renaissance man,
man, in every sense of that word as well. And another interesting aspect of the book, which is bizarre and amusing and somewhat depressing in places, was the fact that in the 1920s, there was a foreign colony living in Peking consisting of about roughly 2,000 Europeans and Americans who worked for European companies or American companies or were attached to the legations or were at the Peking Union Medical College, and they formed a very tightly knit little clique, as foreign colonies always do.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to take their pleasure where they could find it in the midst of all this civil war going on around them and political chaos, and so they became addicted to dinner parties and to horse racing and to polo matches. And incidentally, Andrews, as I may have said earlier, was a world-class polo player himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And mahjong parties and dances on the hotel roofs. And one occasion during one of the civil wars, an airplane came over every day and dropped black powder bombs on the railroad station trying to hit a train, which it never did. And word spread that this was happening, and so at always around 10 o'clock in the morning, all the members of the foreign colony would assemble on the rooftop of the Peking Hotel and hold what were called bombing breakfast with champagne and watch the bombing and then jump in their cars and go see what damage had occurred. Executions went on constantly. A man was executed on the fender of Roy Chapman Andrews' automobile one day. His son, who's lives in Dallas, George Andrews, was in the car and remembers the episode vividly. And Andrews was absolutely furious that they had done this, because Americans and foreigners of all types were supposed to be immune from any involvement in Chinese political affairs under the treaty that was worked out after the Boxer Rebellion. And so you had Andrews playing at his hunt and polo club, playing polo against another military team from Tientsin or from someplace, with executions going on right across the street. I have photographs in my book, as a matter of fact, of this taking place. And it was a bizarre life, and it forms a very integral part of the book, of the biography.
It is hard for us today to go back and imagine what life was like back then. It wasn't that long ago.
It must have been very difficult to live under those circumstances. You go out shopping, and in a city that was once described as the femme fatale of cities because it had so many charms, mm-hmm. they tied whistles and flutes on the bird tails of birds and released them by the thousands. And there were jugglers on the street and street musicians and acrobats and all of these things going on. And then there would be a severed head or a body hanging in a tree.
It's from the sublime to the
gruesome. The violence that was going on all around or within the city.
We can tell that you relished the research that you did for this book. What are your techniques? Obviously, you looked up people that were still around, that knew. How do you go about
it was a difficult
putting in
thing.
The detail, putting in the
full
picture?
For one thing,
picture.
We got I came to know George Andrews, his son, very, very well. He's a very dear friend. And he was immensely helpful in his recollections because he grew up in the great Manchu
right
palace that served as Andrew's
really?
Headquarters in Peking.
Wow.
And he remembers so many of these episodes. And then Andrew's first wife was killed in an automobile accident in 1959, although they were divorced by then. But his second wife, who, as I said, just died recently at age 91, was a storehouse of information about his later life, and her memory was very, very sharp to the end. And it was difficult finding written sources because often the expedition's staff varied from season to season.
Mm.
Different geologists would come out, if they weren't available for one year, then another one would join the expedition, and two archaeologists changed hands, and
So a lot of continuity there.
And as a result, those men normally didn't keep detailed journals. They were too busy in the field. But they wrote home. They wrote wonderful letters. And so it was a difficult task to try and track down the families or surviving members, which I was able to do with a number of people. But it took a long time. The book was some 20 years in the making, 3 years in production. And once it went to the publisher, because we did a great deal of changing and editing on the basis, among other things, of these new discoveries that were being made while we were putting the book together. And yes, indeed, that was one of the real challenges. Also, there were, when I started the project, there were 32 file cases of material. These were four drawers high, 32 file cases of unclassified documents.
That you had to sort through?
Correspondence that I had to sift through in New York City at the American Museum of Natural History.
My.
Then when they built a new library a few years ago, they found much, much more material. And sometimes my wife and I, and she worked very closely with me on this research material, we would find very important documents that had fallen down behind filing cases years and years and years ago. And,
such as?
These things had to be all put in place. And
so you cleaned up the archives as you were going along. They were probably indebted to you.
Yeah.
Now, when you started out 20 years ago, and I know I can see the attraction as he was a hero of yours, and this is right up your field, did you have any idea it was going to be 20 years later that you would finally finish this project?
No, I didn't. And I must say I did have to take some time out to do other projects, obviously, to keep a roof under which to write, but
got it, yeah.
As all writers do, but I had no idea it would take this long. It turned out to be fortuitous, actually, that it did take this long because of the new discoveries that have come to light in just the last few years. The fact that that Mongolia suddenly opened. I'd been trying since 1976 to get into Mongolia with absolutely no luck whatsoever. And once I'd gotten there, I probably would have had no way to get around. So
you had a much more productive trip when it happened.
But this way, we had the benefit of new discoveries and new interpretations and being able to go to Mongolia. And
you must be in touch with all of the dinosaur scientists and the dinosaur hunters today in order to keep up with all of the latest research
and all of this. We've stayed in very close touch, working closely with the American Museum with Michael Novacek there, who is the vice president and the leader of these expeditions to Mongolia, and Mark Norell, Malcolm McKenna, a whole group of paleontologists who could not have been more supportive and cooperative. And they all had Roy Chapman Andrews as their boyhood heroes as well.
That was an important contribution that Roy Chapman made then, Andrews.
Indeed he did.
Of writing it up and inspiring the next generation.
Indeed he did. He
How did he get to be so talented? What was his upbringing that made him such a special guy?
Very interesting. He came from a modest background, and he was born in Beloit, Wisconsin, as I said, in 1884. His father was a wholesale druggist. He graduated from Beloit College in 1906. He was not an outstanding student. He was an average student. And he had always known that he wanted to be an explorer and scientist. There was never any doubt in his mind. Over and over in his publications, he said, "I never had a choice of professions to make. It was already made. I knew this is what I was going to do. It was only a matter of how." Well, that how came along in a most interesting way when a professor of geology came to Beloit, Wisconsin to lecture at Beloit College. And Andrews approached him, and Andrews had become an expert taxidermist by this time, so he took this man to see some of the animals that he had prepared, displayed around town. And man suggested that he write the director of the museum and apply for a job. Well, he did, and he got a letter back perfunctorily thanking him, but saying that no positions were available. But if he ever came to New York, that he would talk to him. Well, Andrews jumped, but he said not to make a special trip.
Well, of course he did.
Of course he did. The moment he graduated, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, he was on the train with $30 in his pocket, his life savings. He refused any money from his parents at all. And he walked into the director's office, had an appointment, and the director told him again there were no positions available in the museum. And in a very famous incident that has been written about many times, Andrews said, "But you need someone to sweep the floors, don't you?" And the director said, "A man with a college education would never be happy sweeping floors." And Andrews, very shrewdly, I think, replied, "No, not just any floors, but the museum floors are
what a salesman.
Are different." Yes, what a salesman he was throughout his life.
And how smart to get his foot in the door in any way that he could.
Needless to say, he got a job for $40 a month, and believe it or not, it was sweeping floors in the taxidermy department. And within a few weeks, he was off and running with his career studying whales, and the rest is history.
You know, what's interesting, though, is that his success can't be attributed just to academic smarts. It was his full personality. It was the astute street smarts that he had that also helped to open the doors for him.
He had very minimal academic credentials. He did receive a master's degree from Columbia University in 1913 in zoology, and he had a position as curator in the Department of Zoology. But as he always said, "I never had enough time to curate because I was never in the museum. No sooner did I get back from one expedition than I already had another one planned." And after he gave up whaling, he took off on a long trip through northern Korea to the Manchurian border to explore an area called the Long White Mountain. And after that, he and his first wife made a 30,000-mile journey through Yunnan province in China into Burma, Tibet, and Vietnam, collecting zoological specimens for the museum. Following that, when the First World War broke out, he served as an intelligence agent, a spy for naval intelligence, and was sent back to China and Mongolia under the guise of collecting for the museum. And a year after that, in 1919, after the war ended, he was back in Mongolia again on another zoological expedition. And it was while he was in Mongolia, first as an intelligence agent and then on this zoological expedition, that he decided that the Gobi was the place that he wanted to conduct this great expedition to look for.
He sounds like a real-life Indiana Jones, just with dinosaurs rather than...
He's often been compared to Indiana Jones, and indeed he did go forth with pistols strapped on his hip and a campaign hat and boots. And he did hate snakes, as Indiana Jones did. And he did shoot bandits, if necessary, on several occasions.
Well, maybe a competing studio will be tapping you on the shoulder to consult for a new
George
figure.
George Lucas vehemently denies that he used him as a model. But he said Indiana Jones, Indiana was the name of a dog that he had when he was a boy. But who is to say what remains in the subconscious mind, and who is to say that somebody else working on the film didn't conjure up visions of Roy Chapman Andrews during the making of that film? I mean, it's an open, debatable point and an interesting one.
You know, the lesson here, too, is that you have a passion, you feel you have a destiny, and you just make it happen. And it takes all of those various skills. You don't have to be the brightest in your class. You don't have to get the best grades in order to succeed wonderfully.
Well, his autobiography is entitled Under a Lucky Star, and luck played an enormous role
in his life as well.
But everything you say is true. But luck was a real factor with Andrews.
How many opportunities happen to each of us that would be considered luck when we take them at the ball and run
right,
with it?
Exactly.
But if we pass them, let them pass us by, then they're not registered as luck.
But I also know so many people who prepare themselves so well and put everything into place. It should happen, and it doesn't. You know.
So what is that? What is that difference?
That's metaphysical.
Charles, thank you so much for this story, and you tell it so well. The science of it, the high action adventure, real life adventure of it, understanding a man and how he was able to do so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee. This has been Conversation for Exploration, and I want to thank you for joining us on our tour around the universe at large here tonight. And join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.